Andalusia, the last holdout of Islamic Spain, when the sword of Islam ruled half the known world and Europeans were subject to their rule. The land is littered with relics of the Muslim occupation in the built landscape, the language, and even the genetic profile of its inhabitants.
Hello. This is the Alhambra Mosque, and behind us, Granada, the last holdout of Islam in Europe, the last Muslim city in Europe protected by the Sierra Nevada mountains, which finally fell to the Crusaders in 1492, which meant that Islam and Islamic culture was completely removed from Europe. Now, if I was being a tad uncharitable, I would say that the reverse is now happening, that Christian culture is shrinking in Europe and Islamic culture is, how can we put this nicely, encroaching somewhat upon it.
The only solution is jihad by the armies of the Muslim country.
Will not be silent. We will raise the voice of Gaza. We will raise the voice of Palestine. Allahu Akbar!
And encroaching somewhat upon the traditional Christian Europe that I at least was brought up in. So I rather thought, in the spirit of sort of jolly heretic public house naughty inquiry, I might come here to Granada and have a look at what it's like and what it meant genetically, what it meant culturally, what it meant in terms of evolution for Islam to be removed from Europe. What were the evolutionary dynamics that caused the Moors to lose and fail and be removed from Europe? What were the evolutionary reasons why the Christians were able to conquer them, and why might that happen for perhaps similar reasons in reverse in our own time? In 611, the Muslims, fired up by their new religion, made their way out of the desert. Only 100 years later, by 711, their empire stretched from Afghanistan to Spain. Entering Spain in 711, they put the new, highly divided, fractious population under the jizya, a special tax which only non-Muslims had to pay. This meant that many non-Muslims converted to Islam in order to not pay the tax. They were so successful, they made their way north all the way into France, into the Loire Valley, losing the Battle of Tours in 732 when they were stopped in their tracks by Charles Martel.
The Battle of Tours was the first hard stop in over a century of Muslim expansion. When the Muslims exploded out of the deserts of Arabia, they tore through the ancient empires of late antiquity. Vassals of the Byzantines and the Persians, weakened by centuries of war, crumbled in the face of a well-organized enemy, emboldened by a fanatical devotion to their faith. Egypt, the land of the pharaohs, Mark Antony and Cleopatra, which once boasted the greatest city in the world, Alexandria, was conquered by a few thousand men. When faced with a brutally effective, well-organized invader, even the mighty can crumble into dust. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Europe was a patchwork of warlords and proto-kingdoms, Roman power long since faded from memory. Its green pastures looked on with envious eyes from the desert.
What is it that makes a successful invader? Well, one of the key factors is known to be ethnocentrism, positive and negative ethnocentrism. Positive ethnocentrism is that you're positively cooperative, you're internally cooperative, you cooperate together, you get things done. Negative ethnocentrism is you hate the outsider, you want to kill the outsider. The outsider is other, the outsider is evil. And computer modelling has shown that when you set up a number of different groups, one that is that are different in these different factors, it's the group that is high in positive and negative ethnocentrism that always wins the day. The second factor is an element of intelligence, the group that has the best weapons, the group that has, as it were, a genius cast that can come up with fantastic weapons that ensure sure that they can smash up the other group. That's the other thing. And it's that ultimate combination of intelligence and positive and negative ethnocentrism. And a big part of positive and negative ethnocentrism is religion. Because what religion tends to do is it takes that which is adaptive at the group level and it makes it into the will of God. It fires people up. It makes them feel they've got something to live for, they've got something to die for, more importantly. They've got a sense of the eternal. It takes that, evolutionary adaptive, and it elevates it. And that is what, at this stage in history, in the 700s, that is what Islam was like. High in positive and negative ethnocentrism, fired up by this relatively new religion, reasonably intelligent to the sounds of the time, and therefore they were able to come in, particularly in a Spanish society that was disunited, fractious, low in positive ethnocentrism, and take over.
Though any interrogation of the origins of Islam will doubtless be met with inquisitional rage, there has been some courageous scholarship in recent years over how long it took Islam to congeal into a new religion of its own right. There is some suggestion that the very earliest Muslims did not see themselves as belonging to a separate religion at all, but rather as a select tribe of true believers in the Abrahamic faith, long since corrupted by a distant priesthood and the earthly concerns of their rulers.
People often think, with the current situation where a significant portion of Muslims hate Jews, and we have all this rising anti-Semitic hate crime since the Palestine incident, which we know is Muslims versus Jews.
Stop the Jews! Stop the movement! Stop the Muslims! Stop the mothers! Stop the daughters! And join the support for
Palestine! It has always been like that. Muslims don't like Jews. But that's simply not the case. And that was not the case during the time of Moorish Spain. It was the Christians that persecuted Jews. It was the Christians that, for example, expelled Jews. King Edward I that expelled Jews from England. Jews were subject to intermittent pogroms. Jews were subject to huge levels of discrimination in what jobs they could do and everything else. This was simply not the case in Islamic Spain. Jews were tolerated. They could practice their religion. They could do pretty much whatever they liked and be left alone as long as they paid the jizya, as long as they paid the tax. And so, of course, they were perfectly happy to stay in Islamic Spain. Islamic Spain was better for them than Christian Spain. And they happily cooperated with the Islamic leaders because it was just better for them. They were not being persecuted. They were not being subject to pogroms. They were not being killed. They were able to get on with it. And indeed, some of them would even go so far as to convert. There was a lot of conversion from Judaism to Islam, which was a problem, of course, for the Muslims, because it meant that there weren't enough people paying their tax anymore. But it was also, of course, a problem because there is an extent to which religion is symbolically, to a great extent, religious differences are symbolically ethnic differences. And once you allow lots of people from a different ethnic group to convert into your own ethnic group, then you blur the borders of the ethnic group, and this can be seen to interfere with the genetic interests of the ethnic group and the future of the ethnic group. But it was a very, very different world. It was a world in which, in many ways, the Christians had the radical fundamentalist fervour of the stereotypical Islam today.
One of the great legacies of Islam was Arabic. Despite all the power of Rome, Latin never supplanted Greek, the lingua franca of the East Mediterranean, or Berber, the language of North Africa, Aramaic, the vernacular of Christ, or Coptic, the tongue of the pharaohs. However, within two centuries, all these regions were thoroughly Arabized. It was an empire of words, a conquest of the linguistics and the very thought processes of its subject peoples. However, the language of the new ruling elite was not simply a liturgical language. It was the language of God himself, and the recitation of the Testament of Faith in Arabic was a prerequisite for entry into the gates of heaven. Once again, the supreme ruler of the universe happened to speak in the words and customs of the warrior elite, this time born of the nomadic tribes of the Arabian Peninsula. If you've ever wondered why working class, second generation immigrants on the streets of Luton or Bradford sprinkle Arabic words and phrases into their everyday speech, this is why.
The Arab language had tremendous influence on the Spanish language. Basically, any word in Spanish that begins with al or anything that sounds a bit like it ultimately comes from Arabic. So Andalusia, Alhambra, azúcar, which is sugar. Even the definite article in Spanish is el, where the is el, whereas it's la in all other Romance languages. Does the el come from Arabic? Probably. Am I sure about that? No, not really. I mean, look it up, to be honest. But it probably does. But also, what about the genetic language? What did it do to the genetics of the region? 15% of the genetics of native Andalusians these days comes from Arab origin. So there were obviously mixtures between the two populations. Now, what would we expect to happen now if Spain and Andalusia is reconquered by Muslims? Well, we would expect to find that there would be some kind of genetic mixing. What is that genetic mixing? Well, normally it's in the direction that the male invader will make his imprint on the local female population. And that is why we have seen in Rochdale, in Rotherham, even in Oulu, these grooming gangs where you have men, if you're a man in evolutionary terms, and you come in and you're an invader, of course what you want to do is take the women of that society. It's even been speculated that that's why women speak foreign languages better than men, because they are evolved to be abducted by a foreign tribe and taken away. You take their women, you impregnate them, and the children are no longer part of the native population, and perhaps they become part of your population, but either way, you make your print on the society. In terms of grooming gangs, often in polygamous societies, and we are evolved to be a polygamous society until relatively recently, then the dominant males get all of the women, and the only way that you can pass on your genes as a less dominant male is to gang together and create basically a rape gang. And that is what they did. And it's been suggested that this is why men find violence arousing. This is why there is a fusion in the male mind between sex and violence, because we are descended from men who engaged in systematic and frequent rape. It is why, indeed, there is evidence that men will ejaculate more when they are watching violent pornography than watching so-called vanilla pornography. We are descended from rapists. And so you would expect this culture of getting together into groups, of grooming the young girls of the native population, taking control of the young girls and impregnating them to occur. And of course, surprise, surprise, that's exactly what has occurred. If you want to understand what's going on in Rotherham, Oulu, Rochdale, wherever, all you have to do is look at evolutionary psychology. So what was the kind of Spain which the Moors invaded? Well, it was a Spain that was populated by the Visigoths. The Visigoths were a Germanic people, and we don't quite know how they ended up in Spain. This is the problem with the Dark Ages. Their origins aren't entirely known. Now, once they arrived, what happened? Well, you have this intermixture between the native population and the Moors. But it's an intermixture in a particular direction. And that direction tends to be that it would be local white girls, local Visigothic girls, who would be having relationships with men. Now, why is this the case? Why would they do this? Why would they want to have a relationship with a foreigner? Well, there are two key factors that predict why a woman is sexually attracted to a man. The first factor is just genetic similarity. If you go for somebody who is genetically highly similar to you in terms of genetic traits, highly genetic traits such as intelligence or just what you look like, then you are indirectly passing on more of your genes. You're also ensuring that your children are more similar to you, so you're passing on your genes, and you're more likely to care for them and cherish them because they're more similar to you. So you're setting them up for a more nurturing and loving environment. But another thing which women are highly attracted to is status in men. And the reasons for this is because if you sexually select for a high status man, then it means that he's more likely to have resources which he can invest in you and which he can invest in the offspring, and they're more likely to survive. And also the fact that he has high status could be seen as evidence of just objective genetic quality. He has certain qualities which are under strong selection, and these have allowed him to accrue high status. So there's that balance between the two. And some females are going to be more attracted to genetic similarity, and some females, a certain kind of female, perhaps you might say, that is perhaps in an unstable, dangerous ecology in which she absolutely needs someone to look after her and absolutely needs a very, very high status and just wants genetic quality, doesn't care about genetic similarity, that kind of woman would engage in collaboration horizontale, and that is what so many of these local Visigoth women did with the Arab males.
Language wasn't the only cultural heritage bequeathed by the Moors to Spain. The oud, a pear-shaped stringed instrument dating back in the 7th century, was a popular instrument played at royal courts of Muslim Spain. As its distinct sound and design influenced Spanish luthiers, it was adopted and modified over time by Europeans and evolved to have a slightly smaller body, a bend in the neck, and eventually it became the guitar, one of the most iconic instruments of all time. Listening to the Arab oud, you can hear the Arabic strumming patterns and melismatic passages that would make Spanish classical guitar music so distinctive.
So, they're just sort of showing off, really. I mean, this is people of the sand, people that originally come from desert conditions. Having water, pretty important. Having water, more important than camels. Having water, more important than, well, sand. So you can see that they were brilliant engineers of water. And if you go into the Alhambra, they're all the time fountains, all the time flowing water, showing off just how much they can control water. Water and control it, that's the thing you need to be able to do in harsh conditions, in desert conditions. So you've got people of the desert that come somewhere where there's all this water, and as far as they're concerned, this is a land of milk and honey, but they've still got that instinct to love water and to worship water and to respect it and want to control it and show off how they got of it and do things with it. And you see this everywhere here, all this lovely, lovely water. So you see the scale of this place. I mean, it'd be pretty difficult to successfully attack, but they just surrendered it. Water. The Moors were finally expelled from Spain with the fall of Granada in 1492, the Reconquista. So what could we expect from a Muslim Reconquista of Europe? Well, we're already seeing it. We have two schools at the moment in the UK that are under serious threat because they have failed to accommodate their Muslim pupils. And so what you will see is if you have an intransigent, and there's a lot of research on this, an intransigent minority who are highly united, who are high in positive and negative ethnocentrism, let's remember that, then they will trample over a disunited majority, and that disunited majority will, in many cases, if they're not under great social and economic stress and they just kind of want to grill, will have an inclination to back down, will have an inclination to accommodate them, will have an inclination to make them feel welcome, will have an inclination to just do what they want.
He's a very, very silly 14-year-old boy who does have some challenges. He does suffer with high functioning autism. It means that socially he doesn't always realise what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. And on this occasion, he has been completely disrespectful. He hasn't understood how sacred your holy book is.
And so gradually, of course, as there's more and more of them and they feel more and more confident, they will assert themselves. You will have a situation where you will only be able to purchase halal food. You will have a situation where there will be the call to prayer across most British cities. You may have a situation where we start taking Friday and Saturday off, but not Sunday off. And it will just be done with salami tactics. One, and we won't be able to eat salami, perhaps. Perhaps they'll get rid of pork. But with salami tactics, one step at a time, until gradually we look back and we think, good God, we've been conquered. Speaking of salami tactics, you may have noticed if you ever come to Spain that they are very into their chorizo. They're very into their pork products. Now, why is this the case? Well, the first reason is that, of course, Spain, until quite recently, was a rather poor country, and the pig is the cheapest garbage to meat machine that has ever been known to man. Well, except perhaps for the American. But the other reason, of course, is it was a marker of your religiosity. It was a marker of your Christianity. Islamic Spain was relatively tolerant of Jews, and it was relatively tolerant of Christians. Once the Christians came in 1492, Spain was not tolerant of Jews, and it was not tolerant of Muslims. We had the Spanish Inquisition. And so, of course, you had people who were Jews pretending to be Christians, people that were Muslims pretending to be Christians. The chorizo, the pork, was a way of marking them out, a way of ensuring they offer you chorizo, you take it, clearly you are genuinely a Christian. If you refuse to take it, you are not one. You are not on their team. You are not really a member of their ethnic group, of their religious group. You can't be trusted. So this is the darker side, shall we say, of the Spanish sausage.
El único y verdadero.
No
one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It is often said that no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. But in evolutionary terms, in terms of conquest, you most certainly should expect the Spanish Inquisition. When there is a reconquista, there will always be a period when the new people, the people that have taken charge, will take absolute vengeance on their former masters. They are now free, they are now liberated, they are now full of anger, and they will go out and destroy them. And the second reason is because they want to make sure that it is their genetic interests, it is their people who are actually surviving. Now, how do you survive in newly Christian Spain? Well, of course, what you do if you're a Jew or you're a Muslim is you pretend, particularly if it was a Jew, is you pretend to be a Christian. You become what was known as a crypto-Jew. And so this is one of the things which the Spanish Inquisition was, in theory, trying to flush out. Jews that had returned to the religion of their ancestors. In reality, of course, this is not what happened at all. In reality, many Jews converted to Christianity and indeed were Christians for many generations, but from an evolutionary perspective, they were considered still to be a different ethnic group, still to be non-Spanish. Therefore, from an evolutionary perspective, they were an enemy. They were competing for scarce resources. This was group selection. They were competing against a different group. And the Spanish Inquisition, the religious persecution, was an excuse, essentially, to find people who had converted from Judaism and effectively remove them from the society. Why do Inquisitions tend to go too far? Why do they end up killing their own?
Are you ready for the future of the West?